This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
You're listening to On A Good Day with me, Elizabeth Callahan.
And me, Julia Ajayi. This is the podcast which delves into brain injury and its impact on all involved.
Welcome to this episode of On A Good Day. Today, we're looking at the time immediately after a brain injury, when a loved one's in hospital, and the days, weeks and months in Julia and I's cases following it. I remember it being a hugely challenging time of uncertainty and just not knowing what to do or what was happening. Well, joining us to discuss this topic and give her insight and knowledge on how best to deal with the situation is Susie Barker, who's an advisor at Adam Brooks Hospital in Cambridge and works closely alongside the brain injury charity Headway.
Susie assists brain injury survivors and their families while they're in hospital, meeting them at a time of crisis and giving free information and advice. I was lucky enough to meet a Headway worker just like Susie when my husband was in Adam Brooks, so I know firsthand just how important her work is.
Welcome, Susie. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Hello. Hi, thank you.
Now, what you do is a service that's not available in all hospitals. I personally didn't have a Susie when my husband, Paul, had his brain injury. And I know many of our listeners won't either. Can you start by giving us an idea of the kind of advice and help that you give at what is a really difficult time for families and their loved ones?
My role in the hospital is part of the Major Trauma Signposting Partnership. So I work really closely with the major trauma teams, and anyone who comes through Adam Brooks Hospital who has a brain injury through a major trauma will be referred to our service. Really, we're there to offer that support from Headway and guidance, just so to help people understand what brain injury is, what the impact can be, and what resources are actually there, and what worries they have at the moment, and how I could help them explore that and what that might look like. And really helping people to manage expectations as well. You know, there's a lot of, you both have experience of brain injury. There's a lot of time and a lot of patience involved. And people want to know what to do in that time and how best to help their loved one or how best to help themselves. So we look at lots of techniques around managing fatigue, for example, further down the road to recovery. I've also done quite a bit of work around how to speak to someone who's in a coma. What do we say? What do we do? What's helpful for me? What would be helpful for them? And also to something tangible to give to friends of theirs or schools or if it's a young chap, you know, that I've recently been working with, helping his friends understand why he can't game for 2 or 3 hours at a go, why, you know, his processing isn't what it used to be, why, you know, no one can give an answer as to when he's going to be exactly the way he used to be and why that might never happen, and just really helping people keep relationships and also explore new pathways and new relationships.
That's great, Susie. Thank you. I think that's a really great overview. What are the questions you get asked most often?
The question is all about time. Have you ever seen someone who's this bad before who comes through? Can you give me examples? People are always wanting to know, is this going to get better? Have you experienced someone being this unwell and getting better? And of course, you know, I don't have those answers. So it really is helping that person understand that actually no one really has those answers at that point. And, you know, how best to just look at the journey and where they're at and where they can work together to move forward. It's just helping somebody understand that they're just part of that whole process, that whole journey, and how important it is for them. But it is the most asked question is, how long will this take? And, you know, will it be okay? And that's, of course, a really difficult question to manage. The other question a lot is around fatigue. It's the most common question around managing fatigue and the impact that fatigue actually has on relationships and work-life balance, you know, further along, and also on education, young people going back to school. And we do have, you know, lots of techniques that you can use, and, you know, it's recognising that you need to have guilt-free naps, and you have to have, you know, guilt-free time to actually prepare for an event that's happening on Friday. You might have to start actually looking at that on Tuesday, Wednesday, you know, all of these different things. But fatigue is a major one, and memory as well. It is a really hard one for people to go from, you know, being in a job where they're, you know, very quick executive functioning to not being able to have word recall. And, you know, of course there is techniques, but again, that's all about time scale and recovery and really helping people understand what that processing is and how they can help their partner or son or daughter to, you know, develop those skills further. So those are other common questions. And again, another one is what is out there? What is out there for support? So we would, you know, refer people to... Well, this is going to be a wonderful resource to your podcast, but also to other people's blogs, looking at other people's stories, you know, just really understanding that people have got through this and their journey continues and it's doable, and perhaps there is peer support out there. So it's really just about linking people in with that in the community as well. And of course, we have wonderful headway services in the community, so we link straight into those and to the surrounding areas as well.
I think you're right. People want to have that reassurance, they want to have an element of hope. And obviously the thing with brain injury, everybody is so different and there is no definitive answer. A lot of it is based on the patient and how hard they work, and there's so many things around it, isn't it? So I can totally resonate with all of those questions that people ask.
And I think that's right when you say about hope, when I mentioned earlier about managing expectations, that is not to dampen people's expectations. That's, you know, really to encourage hope and how positive hope, you know, can be, and how that comes across to the patient and for your family. And, you know, in times when it's so uncertain, you know, what's going to happen in the future, I think that hope gets people through. And, you know, it is a very important aspect of the pathway, really.
Definitely. And I mean, you all have seen so many different ways in which people and families deal with this kind of situation. From your experience, what are the most kind of positive things that families can do in this situation for themselves and for the person who's had the brain injury?
Yeah, of course. I mean, I think there's a lot of self-care, you know, when I am speaking to people who are relatives or next of kin, it's really, you know, reminding yourself to look after yourself. When there's people surrounding you that are offering help, they genuinely mean it. Pull in as many resources as you can. Make sure that you are having that support for yourself so that you can support, you know, your loved one. And I think having that sort of calming presence and being around somebody where you've got, you know, some sense of what's going on at home, just to make sure that you're keeping them up to date about what's going on at home, maybe keeping some diaries, you know, perhaps just all of the things that happen in our lives that still have to happen and have to continue, make sure that you're including that person in those choices and in those, and in that feedback. And it's just about, you know, trying to make sure that you have that support, that you're aware of what support is available in the hospital and what support your friends and family are able to give. But also making sure that person who's experienced a brain injury are still included in that family dynamic and part of it.
I think what you mentioned there, Susie, about self-care is so important, but can be one of the most difficult things at that time of crisis to think about and to be aware of as well. I do remember, you know, people saying, oh, go home and have a rest. And, you know, self-care is really important. But when there's so much going on at that time of crisis, I think often we do forget about it. So it's great to have that message reinforced.
Yeah. And, you know, some of those things that you're talking about that you have to do, it becomes a very busy time for people, you know, when there's been, you know, a trauma or an acquired brain injury. There's lots to do. There's lots of practical things to do. Quite often, you know, there's financial issues to worry about. There's, you know, there's the practicalities of, you know, how do we get the children to school? How do I visit? There's all of these things. And, you know, if we could sit down together and perhaps work out what that looks like and who could help where, you know, I'm more than happy to do those pieces of work. And, you know, I really enjoy helping families look at that. And again, that's why it's so good. I feel very lucky to be in the position with the Major Trauma Signposting Partnership, because I can say, well, actually my colleague who works for the Citizens Advice, this is, you know, we'll refer you there. They will call you straight away. You don't need to be on the phone for hours. We can pull in the knowledge that's in that major trauma team that we sit with, because I'm actually based in that office. And we have, you know, really good advisors on legal. So there's lots of those practicalities that are just whizzing around in relatives' head that you think, how do I do this? We can, you know, help to alleviate some of those issues so that we can concentrate on understanding that brain injury and what the effects that has.
Going back a little bit to kind of the role of the family and particularly children. I mean, Julia and I both had quite young children when our husbands, that, you know, fairly young. Mine was 38 when he had his stroke. How do you find having, you know, the children visiting in hospital? Like, what are the kind of best ways to go about that and explaining to the children what's happened and how to deal in that situation?
It can be quite frightening for children. So coming into an environment where there's lots of beeps and alarms and, you know, they don't know whether it's someone calling for to go to the loo or whether, you know, it's something quite scary happening. So an introduction to what a hospital feels like, looks like, arranging a space where the children don't feel boxed in, making sure that the children are prepared. So lots of pictures. Sometimes people can look very different. Some people after their brain injury express themselves in a very different way. So maybe some preparation with some video calls first off. And also perhaps just really speaking to the team before this happens and making sure that, for example, if daddy's been looked after by one of the coordinators who they're very close to, making sure that the coordinator has time to come and say hi. So, you know, this is what I do. This is how I look after your dad. And, you know, so they get a sense of what's going on and, you know, a sense of safety that, you know, that their father may be getting looked after well by these nice people who came and said hello. And, you know, there's a bit of kindness and care there. And the other thing is actually on the day of visits to make sure that you have perhaps a little indication word, you know, sentence that the child can say when they've had enough and they want some time out. So, you know, perhaps this is quite difficult for them to handle. So if they say, can I have a drink now, mummy or, you know, daddy, that would be the indication that you would want to take a bit of time out and step away and have a chat. But yeah, so there's lots of different techniques to prepare children. But, you know, definitely preparation is key. So what to expect and what's going to happen on the day and how they're going to deal with that. And also time. Really limit the visits, very, very short periods of time, just an introduction to how that care is going.
The other thing, Susie, that I found with my two when my husband was in hospital was that they had different feelings about it. Okay. As well. They were different ages. Yeah. They're 5 years apart, but actually one felt much more comfortable going in than the other one. And I think respecting that difference of feeling and going with when they feel is the right time for them as well. I don't know what you think about that.
I think that's definitely right. I mean, I think you've got to think about it. It's got to be for the children. You know, I know that it must be incredibly important for somebody who's recovering from brain injury to want to see their children and to have that need. But for that relationship and that trust to be there, it's got to be at the right time for the children. And, you know, it of course it's age dependent, but it might be, you know, very important for the teachers to know, for any other support that's going on around their child, so that there can be, like, you know, some real support leading up to that. And again, letting the children know, that must have been quite difficult for one to have felt comfortable and the other not, because there'll be a guilt associated with that and everything else. So it's just about making it very much about choice and making it okay, and it being okay to make those choices and decisions, and for everybody to be different and understand that. That must have been quite tricky, I imagine.
Yes, it was. But actually, we also used letter writing and took in letters that they had written, which was great, actually.
That's really lovely, actually, because it's really tangible, isn't it? It's something that can stay there past the Zoom call and past the phone call. It's really nice to have that sort of, letters and written word. It's a great idea.
It was quite an emotional experience having to read it out. And in fact, I had to get a friend to read out the letter
for
my daughter because I was in tears. But yes, I think it was. It was a great thing to do, actually.
Yeah. There are so many different ways now. I mean, we did a lot of sort of cards, writing to Daddy. I mean, it was very young. There wasn't like long letters that we could necessarily write, but also made use of videos as well. It's so easy now with technology. But going back to what you were saying about limiting kind of the time that you spend, and that probably goes across the board, doesn't it, with other visitors because of that fatigue that they can get.
Yeah, and that goes for, like myself, even visiting the ward. I'm really aware that at the moment we've only got, I think it's 2 hours visitation a day. So for two different people in the family. So, I try to make my visits really short and sweet and sort of planned. So I know that I'm going along to do. But I mean, I think it's nice for somebody to sit in silence and keep someone company, but I think the expectation to be able to engage in a conversation, even with the mildest of brain injuries, when it's very new, it can be very tricky. So limiting expectations on the amount of input that you're going to have from a patient or a relative who's had a brain injury, for sure. Yeah.
I do think that also at that time when talking can be so difficult, that just the power of positive touch, just by holding hands or stroking someone's arm, or looking into someone's eyes, is so powerful.
Of course. It's such a huge part of recovery, it is that reassurance and touch. It's human nature, isn't it? It's what we all crave to heal. And how difficult that must have been for families during the times of COVID, when we weren't able to to do that. It's unimaginable how difficult that must have been.
Absolutely. I think it must have been hugely difficult for people not to be able to reach out in that very natural way. And my thoughts are with those families that had to deal with this through that time. I think it was also interesting when you mentioned the work that you've done and conversations you've had with friends of a young man that you are working with at the moment. And I think part of us coming together with this podcast is not only thinking about families, but also those wider circles of friends and community, because as we know, they're so important to the recovery of someone, or the progress that someone can make, and how we're supported as a family. So how do you see the role of friends, both in hospital and when someone leaves hospital?
It's tricky because, long established friendships, if you're more mature in age, can see itself quite nicely over trauma and brain injury. But when you're working with young people, the dynamics of friendships change so much when somebody's personality has shifted even just slightly. It can be quite tricky. So it's about positive reinforcement for those friends that, it's okay to ask questions. It's okay to be a bit different around your friend. It's about helping them understand that they can adapt their friendship to match what's new and what's going on and what's, how things are developing. It's tricky. It is tricky for young people to adapt in that way, but just to offer them that support is key. And again, with brain injury, some good comes out of that. And I've seen, especially in our hub services, how new relationships develop and how important it is to actually reach out and see other people in your peer groups that have experienced similar things to yourself, and perhaps make new friends and new relationships. Again, for older people or people of more mature age, it is just about allowing, the understanding of what that brain injury looks like, and perhaps how you could help with communication. What are the difficulties? What can I do to adapt, and what would be useful?
You mentioned that there was that you offered emotional support as well. What kind of support does that look like?
Well, okay, so I mean, obviously there's psychological support available in the hospital. I'm not a trained counsellor, so when I say emotional support, it's really a listening ear. Quite often, the wards can be very busy. People in general have an anxiety of taking up a very valuable nurse's time or a doctor's time. And, you know, we're lucky enough to be in the hospital, to go to those ward meetings that happen, to be able to interact with all those other professionals and take some questions to the other professionals. So they're just to give that time and listen and see where we can, you know, refer them on to, or whether we could have a little bit of an impact if we then spoke to a nurse about their concerns or a doctor about their concerns. And it's really just, when I say emotional support, it really is just listening to that person and hearing what they have to say and where they're at.
One thing I'd like to just pick up on, Susie, from what you said before, is you mentioned about a personality shift, however small. And I understand that that is, of course, a result of many brain injuries. But also, I think that it isn't always.
No.
And that, however, a loss of capabilities might be, I see it as quite different from a shift in personality. And I just wanted to pick up on that, because I think that some of the effects on friendships and relationships can be similar, because we, as people around someone who've had a brain injury, have to cope with that change in a person. But I think those changes can be due to a change in what someone is able to do, but not necessarily in their personality, but it could be both.
Of course, yeah, I think that's right.
What kind of support do you offer? Because I found, and you will, I'm sure, have seen families deal with things in different ways in hospitals, and there's so much information to take in, and then often it's only when you kind of get home that it really, really hits you, and you kind of think, oh gosh, what was that Susie saying about that service, or to do here, there and everywhere? So what is there after they leave hospital? What do you still connect with those families and survivors?
Of course. So that's the beauty of being with Headway, really, is it, that allows us to continue on that journey. So in the hospital, usually what I would do is be having initial conversations with the patient or with the family. And then I would do a follow-up letter is lovely. But I think for going back and finding something, usually an email is great. So I would send a follow-up email with what we've chatted about that day and some resources that I think might be useful. And then I would reconnect maybe a week or so, whatever time we've arranged, and we can go through some of those resources, and we can have a chat about where we're at and if there's anything else that we can do. And then they've always got my mobile phone number and my email contact, so it's easy just to get back in contact. Lots of the patients that I get referred actually are post-discharge, so they've come back into clinic having been discharged, so we can still pick them up from the major signposting team, and I would contact them at home, and if they were local, refer them into our services or into other Headway services.
Amazing.
I think just the fact that you're providing that continuity, Susie, is really, really important, because you mentioned it's a really busy time, and I think it is, and that continues when you get home as well.
Yeah.
And so the fact that you're reaching out to people, I think, is great, because if it's must phone Susie, another thing on the list that I've got to do, which is a really important thing, but with everything else can sometimes get lost. So I think the fact that you're saying you reach out to people is really, really important. And I also wanted to pick up with on just what you were saying about being able to reach out and ask for help from other people and from Headway. And I think that that's so important. So thank you so much for being there and talking to us today to say what is possible and reminding us about how important all of those connections are.
And just finally from me, what would be the top three pieces of advice that you would give to families and friends at this time on what is a very life-changing event in somebody's life?
Of course, it's don't be afraid to ask the questions and don't be afraid to ask for the help. Sometimes not being able to face something can make it more scary. And pull in as many friends around you as you can. And if you find yourself being isolated, pull in some people from organisations such as ourselves and let us connect you. It's all about having that support around you and making sure that you take up that support from all of the medical teams and all of the people that are offering that socially as well.
Amazing. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
What great advice and tips Susie had. That is definitely an episode I'd have benefited from listening to when my husband Paul first had his stroke. So if you know anyone who may be in a similar situation, please do share this. We want this to be a resource to help as many people as possible. And please do share on social media. If you're listening on your phone, take a screenshot, post it and tag us. We're on Instagram as onagood.day, and we'd love it if you wrote us a 5-star review. For more details on this episode and where to find us, do check the show notes. Thank you for listening, and until next time, have a very good day.